Speak with some apologies to those who weren't able to be here for the preceding sessions, because some of the things I'm going to say reflect back on what we've covered the last couple of days here in our sessions on evolution versus creation. I said last night I'm going to talk this morning about the argument from teleology. That means the argument from purpose and design. Teleos is the Greek word for design, purpose, or completeness. Now, in the history of the debate between creation and evolution, one of the traditional arguments for a creator and a creation is the argument from design. It seems irrational to many people, I'm among them, that if you have a complex design, then you had a designer. If you have intelligence, you must have mind behind that intelligence. Everything in human experience, everything that's ever been observed tells us that if you have mind, if you have intelligence, then intelligence only comes from mind, and that design only comes from a designer. And this was called a teleological argument for creation. The evolutionists have never had a bit of trouble with the teleological argument. They have simply ignored it. A few years ago, about the 1920s, they declared that the teleological argument no longer works, and they haven't thought about it since. They didn't answer it. They just decided that they would no longer consider it a problem. It's a very convenient way to do it. They simply do not address it. I cite as evidence of this, you recall our discussion that when neo-Darwinism became established as the working hypothesis, that is, tiny mutations worked upon by almost imperceptible natural selecting forces, gradually over long periods of time produced minor changes which accumulated into larger changes, which accumulated into new species, and that's how we got mega evolution or trans-specific evolution or big evolution as opposed to microevolution within kinds. Then that became established. And we recall that in 1940, the geneticist at the University of California, Goldschmidt, who was more honest than many, simply said, "Fellas, it doesn't work. We're going to have to quit thinking about gradualism. Creation, evolution by gradual, imperceptible degrees of change." Why? Well, he said, in the first place, there's no evidence for it, not in the fossil record. There isn't any evidence for it in the contemporary, in the living biological order. And then he said, and I'm reminding you of this, he said, it doesn't work anyway because of the world is full of biological forms of life, organs, animals, plants, insects, which could not have appeared gradually. And he was laughed at by the neo-Darwinist community because the neo-Darwinists had decided a long time ago that Goldschmidt was sort of giving in to the teleological argument, and they'd already decided that the teleological argument wasn't any good. They never said why. They just simply said it's any good. So he said, okay, and you recall he challenged his fellow evolutionists. He was not a creationist. He challenged his fellow evolutionists to simply describe, not to furnish evidence, but to simply describe the gradual development over long periods of time of 18 comparatively simple organisms or organs, biological forms, human hair. That's not very sophisticated, comparatively speaking. A feather. Then he did challenge him to deal with the compound eye, and Goldschmidt was categorically ignored. Not a single evolutionist took him up on the challenge. And he died in disrepute among his fellow evolutionists. Well, I would suggest that the teleological argument is a very good argument. And it is one of the traditional arguments. By the way, the Bible uses it. Romans chapter 1, I'm going to mention this again in the worship hour. Romans chapter 1 says that the things of God are clearly seen, being perceived through the things that are made. One of the reasons why miracles have never been the steady diet of the church, and the reason that God has practiced great economy with miracles, he uses miracles reluctantly, and miracles is because miracles are, in general terms, are the presence of miracles signals the absence of faith, not the presence of faith. And the reason being, as Romans 1 explains, Paul explains in Romans chapter 1, that if people are not going to believe in God on the basis of the natural order, it's not very likely to believe in God on the basis of the supernatural. Miracles are not very convincing to people who don't want to believe anyway. I would point out that Jesus, that the greatest miracles ever been performed on earth were performed by Jesus during his ministry, and the people who saw them later cried, "Crucify him." The miracles of Jesus didn't convince very many people of very much, because they didn't want to be convinced. And so men who do not believe, I had a fellow tell me on the university campus one time, he said, I asked him under what terms he would believe in Jesus. Well, he said if Jesus appeared to him and proved himself, he might believe in him. And I said, no, you won't. And I said, it's a psychological fact that if you do not believe on the basis of the creation order, then the appearance of Jesus probably wouldn't make that much difference. And so the teleological arguments that we're going to talk about, the key word in neo-Darwinism is the word adaptation. It's a magic word. Anytime they want to explain, well, here's how they get over the teleological argument, the argument from design, the argument that Goldschmidt himself, who was not a creationist, offered when he said that the world is full of forms that do not permit gradual development. And he said the reason we haven't found any fossil evidence of this gradual development, called transitional forms, is because they never did exist and because they couldn't exist. They have a magic word. They call it adaptation. They get very poetic about it. They talk about nature designing, animals needing certain things. It's a lot of metaphysical nonsense. And that is the key word. It's a code word, adaptation. How did these animals get these highly complex organisms or organs? Well, adaptation. Adaptation to environment over long periods of time. Now, I introduce you to a book. I'm going to read a little bit from it. This is a book called Darwin Retried. It's a little bit outdated. I think it's out of print. Norman Macbeth is an attorney. He was an attorney, as I think I've already mentioned this to those who were here before. He always been interested in science. He's not a creationist. He's an evolutionist. What he says in the book is that neo-Darwinism, which is the version that's in all the textbooks, he said neo-Darwinism doesn't work. He doesn't say, let's go to creationism. He said, let's go to another theory. So this one doesn't work. And what he was an attorney. He got sick and was laid up for about 6 months. And so during the six-month period, he, being an attorney, he put neo-Darwinism on trial. Darwin retried to see if his case would hold up in court. His conclusion was, it won't. It is not. His conclusion was, it is not intellectually coherent. It is not logically coherent. It will not stick together. Given their admitting their premises, it will not hold together logically. And he chides the neo-Darwinists for what he calls the magic wand, wave the wand method. What you do anytime they come up against something that's difficult to explain, they wave the wand and say adaptation. That's what he means. He says, the efforts to explain, you don't mind if I read to you, I haven't done much of that this week. I don't know why I asked you, I'm going to do it anyway. The efforts to explain why, in context here, why these different very complex forms would develop, led to absurdities. It is easy to say that legs are for running, ears are for hearing, but the trouble begins when one ventures a little further. For instance, Sir Julian Huxley says, quote, now, Huxley was the co-worker of Darwin. He was Darwin's second man. Huxley says flowers develop. I'm sorry. This is the son. Julian Huxley is the son of, I believe, of Huxley's co-worker. Anyway, I always get the Huxleys mixed up, and same crowd anyway, doesn't make a difference. He says this: flowers develop distinctive colors to attract bees. And you got this flower sitting there and says, I sure would like to attract some bees so I could pollinate. It's spring, you know. How shall I do this? I think I'll develop colors. Wasps develop their black and yellow stripes to warn enemies of their stings. The partridge, he's quoting Huxley now, the partridge develops camouflage to escape detection by the hawk. This partridge see the hawks coming and say, boy, it sure would be nice to look like a bush. I think I'll look like a bush. The peacock develops brilliant plumage to stimulate his mate. I'm not going to touch that one. That's the end of the quote. Then Macbeth continues. You understand what I'm reading? I'm not reading a creationist. I'm reading an evolutionist who's an attorney who is given to reason. This sort of interpretation is simplistic and open to considerable doubt as to its correctness. It is also open to embarrassing questions, such as why the well-camouflaged grasshopper betrays his location by chirping. But at least it's not errant nonsense such as we find in Professor Tinbergen of Oxford, second only to Conrad Lorenz in The New Science of Ethology and Animal Behavior, some of the biggies, when he says, quote, "The brightly colored patches of skin seen around the genital aperture of female baboons and chimpanzees probably guide the male to the female's copulatory organs," end quote. This kind of childish explanation, quote, which offhandedly assumes that baboons and chimpanzees need more guidance than other primates, is precisely what brought Darwinism into contempt around the turn of the century. Obviously, it is still with us today, although most modern biologists are too sophisticated or too wary to fall into such errors. They have learned, now listen to this quote, and he's exactly right about this, they have learned that it's wise not to try to explain why. What I said was that the theological argument has been declared useless, but nobody ever said why. The answer is how equally difficult, and one seldom finds a scientist rash enough to make an attempt. We are told that the miracles were accomplished by natural selection, working in its usual step-by-step manner, but the steps are not shown. Are you with me now? And this is what Goldschmidt said, show me the steps. Here is an example of what I call the wave the wand method of explanation, although admittedly it is called from a popular book by two professors who are not among the elite of the evolutionists. And he quotes this from a standard evolutionary, a lower level textbook. The animals change too, he's quoting now. Some of the reptiles in the colder regions began to develop a method of keeping their bodies warm. Their heat output increased when it was cold, and their heat loss was cut down when scales became smaller and more pointed and evolved into fur. Sweating also was an adaptation, there's the word, to regulate the body temperature, a device to cool the body when necessary by evaporation of water. But incidentally, the young of these reptiles begin to lick the sweat of the mother for nourishment. Certain sweat glands begin to secrete a richer and richer secretion, which eventually became milk. Thus, the young of the early mammals had a better start to life. I have never... that's beautiful. Anyway, Macbeth says... This is Macbeth again. That's the end of the quote. I have never found any responsible evolutionist publicly creating out of whole cloth this way. The professionals become more prudent. Do not try to explain. Thus, Simpson, G. Gethard Simpson, who we've met already this week, in one of his latest books, declares that the days of confusion are over and that the synthetic theory has found the answers. The synthetic means neo-Darwinism. But never does this sagacious man, that means smart man, venture to discuss a specific case. Just declare, in general, there's no problem. But he never discusses a specific case or to spell out the infinite number of small steps needed. Now, that is, I quote Macbeth because I want you to, for a couple of reasons, to see the kind of material that is available on this subject and to underscore the nature of my remarks this morning, what we're talking about. Now, I want to do the rest of the hour, and I've structured this so I can just go till our time runs out and not lose anything because you know where I'm going. I want to give some examples this morning, and I think the young people will appreciate this, of some of the things that Goldschmidt and Macbeth, both evolutionists, and many others are talking about when they point to the literally millions of forms and activities in the biological order which the evolutionist must ignore if he's going to retain his theory. some of these specifics. One of my favorites here is the Eumenes amidi. The Eumenes amidi is a small wasp. And I'm quoting now. In the early summer, the small wasp-like Eumenes amidi of northern Africa and southern Europe emerges from the pupal state as an elegant insect with yellow and black bands. Soon after mating, the female prepares a house in which her young can develop and sufficient food can be stored. So you got this female wasp, and a wasp-like insect, and so she gets married, and finds she's in a family way, and so it's her job now to have a house ready for the kitties when they come along. She chooses an exposed and sunny situation on a rock or wall and builds a circular fence of small stones and mortar. The mortar being made from dry, flinty dust mixed with her own saliva. She's a stonemason. So you understand? She gets the little stones and builds this mortar wall. The stones are chosen with care, flint being preferred to limestone. She's picky about what she chooses to build with. The fragments selected are all much the same size. Her choice of the most polished quartz fragments suggests, if we are anthropomorphic, that she is not indifferent to the aesthetic effect of her handiwork. He's thinking that she likes the pretty ones, but she's a woman, and women like pretty stones, don't they? As the wall grows higher, the builder slopes it toward the center, kind of like an igloo, and makes a dome, which, when finished, is about the size of a small cherry. It's the dome. This thing is very small. It's a little mortar igloo. Okay? And then the dome on the top of it, the dome on top of the wall is about the size of a small cherry. And then she leaves a hole is left at the top. And on this is built a funneled mouthpiece of cement. Hole at the top, a little funnel mouthpiece of cement. The next task is to collect the food supply for the future grub. That's what they call their kids, grubs. This consists of small caterpillars, about a half an inch long, palish green, and covered with white hairs. These caterpillars are partially paralyzed by the sting of the eumenes. This insect builds a mortar wall with only the prettiest stones. Builds in the shape of an igloo, leaves a hole in the top, and then goes and finds a certain kind of caterpillar and stings it in just the right place to paralyze it without killing it. The caterpillars are partially paralyzed by the sting of the eumenes and are unable to make any violent effort to escape. They are stored on the floor of the cell. She puts them down through the top, and they lay on the floor of this little igloo. Since they remain alive, they keep fresh until the grub is ready to eat them. If they were killed outright, their flesh would soon dry up and rot. When the cell is stocked, a single egg is laid in each house. Okay? Puts the food in, then lays the egg. And the mouthpiece at the top of the cell is closed with a cement plug in which a pebble is set. Mommy? Puts the food in, the living food, makes sure it won't die, lays the egg, and then plugs up the hole. The egg is not laid upon or among the caterpillars, as in many allied species. The caterpillars are only partially paralyzed and can still move their claws and clamp and champ their jaws. Should any of them feel the nibblings of the tiny grub, it might writhe about and injure the grub. Both the egg and the grub must be protected. And to this end, the egg is suspended by a tiny thread of silk fastened to the roof. She's got the grubs down the bottom of this thing, so she suspends her grubs, her babies, or the egg, from the top of the igloo with a silk thread. I mean, first this thing's been a brick mason. Then it's got this hypodermic needle, just where to sting the thing so it paralyzes it. And now it's been like playing spider and manufacturing silk threads. So here's the grubs down below and the egg hanging up in the air. The caterpillars may wriggle and writhe, but they cannot reach the egg. When the grub emerges from the egg, it devours its eggshell, then spins for itself, its mother taught it that, a tiny silken ribbon sheath in which it is enfolded tail uppermost. Then it builds itself a little cocoon, this grub, before it does anything else, with its head hanging down. In this retreat, it is suspended above the pile of living food. It can lower itself far enough to nibble at the caterpillars. If they stir too violently, it can withdraw into its silken sheath. It builds a little fort for itself. And then it'll start eating. It'll reach down and get a bite partially paralyzed caterpillar. But the caterpillar makes a swipe at it. It pulls itself. It knew ahead of time this might happen. So it pulls itself back up into this little cocoon it's made for itself until its breakfast settles down. and it can go back to eating. As the grub grows in strength and size, it becomes bolder. The silken retreat is no longer required. It can venture down, it gets big enough to take care of itself, and live at its ease among the remains of its food. The stone cells are not all stored with the same wealth of caterpillars. It doesn't always put the same number in. Some contain 5 and some 10. You understand? If you broke up in these little igloos ahead of time, you'd find 10 caterpillars in some, 5 in others. Why? The young females, larger than the males, need twice as much food. Women always eat more. Anyway, if the grub is a female grub, it gets twice as much food as if the little baby is a boy. But note that the cells are stocked before the eggs are laid. And that biologists generally believe that the sex is already determined when the egg is laid. How does the Eumenes know the future sex of her eggs? Well, she got this pencil, you know, and put on a string, boy or girl. And how is it that she never makes a mistake? Now, think about that. She knows before she lays the egg whether it's going to be a boy or a girl, and so if it's going to be a girl, she puts 10 in. If it's going to be a boy, she puts 5 in. Now, that is amazing. Now, the point is, here you see everything from the selection of the site to just the right temperature, through the correct building of the little igloo, I call it, which is architecturally sound, through the selection of just the right number of the right kinds of grubs, through the stinging them just in the right place to paralyze them without killing them, through the suspending of the egg from the ceiling above them so the breakfast won't eat the kid, letting the kid eat the breakfast, and the knowledge of the grub, if the grub doesn't make this sheath for itself before it starts eating, it will fall prey to what it's supposed to be eating, to the number and the whole package, you see. It has to exist, and this is what Goldschmidt was pointing out, this kind of thing. It has to exist as is. If any part of that is missing, you do not get evolution because you do not get survival. If the right side is not selected, the temperature will kill it. If without the little igloo itself, who taught it to build that? And if it did build it, if it knew how to build it, let's say it gradually learned how to build it. Can you imagine what the earlier tries looked like? Pyxis wasp saying, you know, I don't like square. My next year I'm not going to build out of limestone. I'm using flint next year. Looks better. But you see, but there wouldn't be any next year. There'd be no survival. And one of the said, well, you know, I can see a convention at the PTA among female wasps who say, you know, we got to start hanging our babies by a string because the caterpillars keep eating them. And you say, yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't we try that? You ever build one before? No, we'll just experiment. No. Can you imagine how did they learn to sting them so that they would could not get away, but would not die. You see, you get my point? I don't have to labor that anymore. The whole system, which is very, very complicated. By the way, it's more complicated than what a lot of adult people can do. It's extremely complicated, but the whole thing has to exist as is, as a functioning system, or it does not exist at all. It does not permit, by the very nature of it, it does not permit gradualism. It seems to have been planned out, does it not? It seems to have been designed. And I think that's a very good argument. Got another example here. This is one of my favorites, the flashlight fish. It's called Photoblepharon, which means eyelid light. It gives the name of this fish, the scientific name. It's the big scientific name for a little fish that may be best described as the underwater firefly of the Red Sea. That's where it appears in the Red Sea. The flashlight fish, as it is commonly called, is one of the few bioluminescent animals of the ocean, of any ocean, and is one of the 4 species of the fish family, and it gives the name. These fishes have large luminous organs located under the eyes that look like little half-moon compartments, little satchels under their eye, little closable packets under their eye. These organisms contain a light-generating bacterium that shares a symbiotic relationship with the fish. Now, this is a whole area that evolutionists generally categorically ignore, and that is the area of symbiosis. Symbiosis means to live together. What the word means, live together. You see, the natural order is filled with examples where different animals, or sometimes plants and animals, live together in a symbiotic relationship, where and that each must have the other. You see, it's one thing to talk about one form of life evolving gradually, but when you have two evolving gradually in a mutually beneficial system, it becomes infinitely more complex. Now, this is a good example of symbiosis. The fish plays host to the bacterium, which cannot survive apart from the fish. The bacteria need the fish to survive. The fish, on the other hand, the bacterium provides the host fish with an effective survival tool. The fish cannot survive without the bacteria. The light is quite brilliant and has been described as being strong as a weak flashlight. There's a black eyelid that comes up from below to cover the light and creates the blinking effect. What this is, a little fish, got this little packet under its eye that it can open and close. And this packet is filled with bacteria that are luminescent, they glow, packed in there. And so anytime he wants to either see where he's going or attract a mate or distract an enemy, often it will, if they're attacked, they will blink here, close it up, and then shoot off here. And they're in very deep water, so the fish that was going to eat it, you know, they'll go for the flash, but the fish has left. But note this. So you have a bag. The bag under his eye is designed for, apparently, appears to be designed, that's the word teleology, appears to be designed for a completely independent life form. The bacteria and the fish are two separate creatures. They reproduce separately. They are not the same animal. But this bag is filled with these glowing bacteria, and they furnish the light, and the fish serves as a host for the bacteria, and they both get along very well, thank you. Now, the question is, how did this gradually develop? Which came first, the bacteria or the bag? You see, if, according to the rules of evolution, anything that's not helpful is selected against, any organ on the body that's not helpful, does not help a creature survive, it is selected against and disappears. Well then, for what possible reason, evolutionary reason, would a fish have, to use their language, the kind of language, what possible reason would a fish have to develop a pouch under its eye? It doesn't help without the bacteria. Who told the fish, work out this system. You grow a pouch, and you see the bacteria say, come to the fish, hey, Charlie, come here. You grow a pouch, and we'll get in it. Help you, help us. Fish says, not a bad idea. We can call it a flashlight. of course, I don't mean to be facetious, but the idea that symbiotic relationship developed gradually is simply ridiculous. And again, when Goldsmith challenged his colleagues to simply explain how it could have happened, not to show how it did happen, they ignored him. Well, why wouldn't they ignore him? They had to ignore him. And as Macbeth says, when Carl Sagan deals with things like this, or you see the series Life on Earth, and they come face to face with these marvels, with the wonders of nature, as they say, they just wave the magic wand, you've seen it. They wave the magic wand and say, adaptation. But you see, that is a lot of mystic nonsense. And I'll point out this, especially young people, anybody that operates that way intellectually has no right to look down their nose at you for being a Christian. And I said before, you see, that is a clear abandonment of the principle of cause and effect. You understand? It is unscientific, it is not rational, to believe in an effect without a sufficient cause. And neo-Darwinian gradualism is simply not a sufficient cause for the effect of symbiotic relationships. Do you understand what I just said? Neo-Darwinian gradualism, which is what's in all the textbooks, is simply an insufficient cause to explain the effect of many things, like the wasp, or the symbiotic relationship, and it is not scientific. It simply does not get the job done to wave the wand and say, well, isn't this a marvelous adaptation? And that is exactly what is done. And it is one of the reasons why Jay Gould and Niles Eldridge, as I have already talked about, are saying, well, why don't we just be honest and admit that there were no transitional forms. It didn't develop gradually. But all of a sudden, the thing just came into being in its fully functional form, which is even more ridiculous. And here's a mother fish that laid an egg, and there was a humongous mutation. This real freak was born, and one of its babies was born with a pouch under its eye that the mother did not have. And by some strange coincidence, next door, another fish laid an egg, and the same mutation occurred and gave it a wife. You had a female, because they got to have somebody to live with, to mate. Or you can't evolve if you don't reproduce. You understand? So you had simultaneous, magnificent mutations, so that fish were born, whereas the parents had no pouch or whatever. The offspring had pouches. You got a male with a pouch, a female with a pouch. They were genetically compatible. They could reproduce and have babies with pouches. And right at that time, they were having a convention in town of luminescent bacteria say, hey, fellas, I found a pouch. And then somebody came along, Mother Nature came along and taught the fish how to use it. Now, by the way, that is the view of the man who went to Arkansas and used his influence to make creation illegal in the classroom. You can see, don't you, why they want to enforce it by law? It simply will not stand up. It will not survive in the form of free discussion and debate. So they're going to say to our kids, look, we're going to pass laws to make sure you believe it. Why? Well, you see, if you can't persuade somebody, then you sort of make the opposition illegal. And that's exactly what they're doing, and I don't wonder at it. Do you have any questions on saying? And boy, the natural order is filled with this, with symbiotic relationships. There's a cactus out west, I can't think of the name of it now, that has a little aperture that it grows. It does the cactus no good at all, but there's a bird out there that has to have that little aperture to survive. The bird doesn't do one thing for the cactus. But the cactus very conveniently has evolved, quote, a little aperture to protect the bird. And so if you cut down all the cactus, the birds all die. But the cactus had no evolutionary following. The cactus does not need the bird at all. Well, then why would it develop this very strange aperture to protect the bird? Nature. Mother Nature. Nature in its wisdom. And all other kinds of mysticism. You have any questions? One of the most amazing things is human life, human reproduction. And new technology is enabling new research in the area of human reproduction. And one of the most amazing, one of the real questions is, as I've touched upon from another angle this weekend, is the question of how the information, sometimes called encoded DNA, how the information in the human cell got there to tell the cells what to become. That every single cell in the human body has the potential to become another complete clone of that body. That is theoretically. Now, the technology has not been developed to make it happen, except in science fiction books. But the theory is sound. Theoretically, a scientist with the technology to do it could take any cell from your body, whether a piece of fingernail, piece of hair, piece of your lip, any cell of your body, and make another one of you. Complete. The problem is how to guide the DNA, because you see, we start out as a single cell, and all the potentials there, and as cells begin to divide, something tells the cells, say, okay, something's sitting there saying, okay, now you four, you're going to become an eye, you head this way, and you start making eyes, and you two, you go with them, because you're going to be eyelids. And don't forget Charlie, because he's going to be an eyelash. And you take him along, and the tear ducts, you fellows, you're next in line. You're number four. You see. And then he said, now we need the brain committee here, because you see, the eyes just bring in the light. It's the brain that does the seeing. And you four guys back there, you're the optic nerve, so you make sure you maintain communication with these guys, because we got to have an eye out of this that can see. Think about the information. Modern technology has produced more information. Let me read an excerpt. This is from Newsweek magazine, by the way. It had a section on science, How Human Life Begins, written by an evolutionist. You understand? Not a creationist. He's marvelous at this. I pick it up in the middle. He's talking about this process. Are you with me? The process as this zygote becomes a fetus, multiplies, how some cells, understand, some cells become one part of the body, some cells become another part of the body, until you get a functioning human body. Biologists believe that some embryonic cells, that is, when this in the early stages, pick up clues to their future from the cells next door. Occasionally, they seem more clever than the scientists who study them. Little rascals. Take cellular navigation, a process crucial to embryogenesis, since many organs grow like frontier towns founded by peripatetic scouts. The one cell will go out and establish a beachhead, call the others in, and become something, a fingernail, a pancreas. The scouts, I love this. This is beautiful. It's like the Old West. The scouts, listen to this, listen to this language. This is called teleological language. The scouts automatically. Oh? Just what does automatically mean? It's kind of like adaptation. Sort of automatically. Well, I'm glad you explained it to me. I appreciate that. I thought it was marvelous. Well, it's just automatic. Well, you'll forgive me. One of my favorite indoor sports is reading evolutionary literature. Beats the comic strips anytime. If you want fiction. You wonder why Isaac Asimov is such a great science fiction writer? He's an evolutionist. And if there's anything that's science fiction, it's evolution. The scouts automatically start moving when things get too crowded in their neighborhood. Kind of like Daniel Boone. You know, he can see the smoke from the nearest cabin. He said, I'm moving on. So make sure you picture this little cell says, Martha, the neighborhood's gone downhill. We're selling. We're moving out. Contact with cells behind them persuade them to move forward and colonize the less congested area. The cell gets bumped and said, oh, I'm going over here. Why? There's more space over there. A few cell migrants are as adept at getting through the embryo as icebreakers through the Arctic. Because, you see, the embryo you can't see it with the naked eye, but it's full of mountains and valleys. They come from the top or crest of the neural tube, the structure that provides the seeds of the nervous system. As the cells travel, they exude a chemical called hyaluronic acid, which acts as kind of a road crew. It opens a path through obstructions and allows cells to move along stringy proteins and sugars that literally form biological roadways. So you got the pioneer cells that when things get too crowded, they don't like it. So they're going to move on into a less crowded area, but they realize that once they get out there, they don't want to be alone. They cannot be alone. Why? Because, you see, it doesn't any good to have an eye without an optic nerve. Others are going to follow them. So what they do is they build a road as they go. A chemical bond, a road, and so others can follow. Crest cells seem to follow these fibers to their final destination between the cornea and the lens of the eye, say, or the digestive tract, whatever. Scientists aren't sure what makes cells stop moving once they get to the right place. Which is okay, because they don't know what gets them moving in the first place anyway. And if you don't know what gets them moving, what difference does it make if you don't know Well, it gets them stopped. For some reason, it was, why do they stop here? By the way, I don't mean to be facetious, but I think you ought to be very glad that they do. How would you like an eye on the back of your head? I remember one time, first time I played football, they had a big pile up, and I had a strange lump on the back of my head. It was my nose. Not really, but if the cells didn't stop in the right place, your eye would be back here, and you could have a thumb on you sticking out of your ear. They know just where to go, and when they get there, they stop. Scientists aren't sure what makes the cells stop moving once they get to the right place, but gradually, the concentration of hyaluronic acid around them drops, and they begin to coalesce. They run out of gas. Now listen to this. Listen to this language. This is in the science section of Newsweek magazine, written by an evolutionist for evolutionists, the very ones who say, oh, the idea of God and design and purpose and direction, that's just a lot of superstitious, that's a lot of medieval superstition. Listen how they write. They are very selective about the company they keep. I mean, we got prejudice, cellular prejudice right from the very, no wonder we have such trouble getting along with other people. Our cells are very, they're very selective about the company they keep. Now, what does that mean? I mean, come on now. Aggregating only with similar cells so that organs form properly. Even when biologists mix up certain kinds of cells in a culture, they sort out liver cells clumping with liver cells, brain with brain, kidney with kidney. The scientist moves the kidney cell over here with the liver, and he says, aha, why don't you become a liver? And the kidney cell says, oh, you're not fooling me, buddy. I'm a kidney. I was born a kidney, and I'm going to be a kidney no matter what. Why? Well, I'm supposed to be a kidney. And I'm going to have nothing to do with those liver cells. Wow, you know, you let one in the neighborhood, and pretty soon everybody wants to become a kidney. I mean, if they're going to... Now, again, you think I'm being facetious. If they're going to talk that way, then let's read them that way. And see, this is the kind of nonsense. And I don't mean to be unkind, but brother, that's nonsense. That is nonsense. And by the way, to show you how very delicate this is, most birth defects happen when just a tiny bit of information gets mislaid. And just a few cells don't get the message about what they're supposed to be. So you have a baby born without arms. You see, not very much has to go wrong. If a telephone message from the DNA gets short-circuited, the marvelous thing, you know, God's right. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, are we not? And I simply urge you not to get into the world of evolutionary nonsense. It's not... It's a way of thinking. By the way, if this kind of thinking, which is called scientific, if that kind of science, that category of science, that quality of science, had been used in other areas of science, say the space program, we wouldn't have got a man to New Jersey, let alone to the moon. You see, they say, well, this is science. And if you ask the question, the embarrassing question, oh, do you mean this is science in the same way cancer research is science or space technology is science? And the answer is no. Listen, this is not science. This is in the science area of Newsweek magazine. What I have just read is not science. It is philosophy. It is irrational philosophy. It is absurdity. And I think Christians ought to be more intelligent and have anything to do with that kind of thing. Well, our time's up. Thank you very much.